Okay, this is chapter 16. We're going to talk about DNA copying or copying of DNA. I'm going to begin with a brief history of copying. Back in 1984, when I was first hired at Los Gatos High School, what we did, I call these the bad old days. We use these things called dittos, and maybe you've heard of them, maybe you haven't heard of them, but they were really, it was really a very unpleasant way of copying papers, you know, for class. What you had to do is you had to take this thing called a ditto, which was a piece of paper with this sort of blue ink on the back, and you would put it in a typewriter, and you would type, and the type would cause it to the blue ink to come onto this paper, the back of this paper, and then you would do that, so you type out your whole, whatever handout you were going to give. Then you go to the copy room, and there would be a ditto machine, which had this sort of rotating drum, and you'd put the ditto on the rotating drum with the blue ink facing out, and then you would turn it on, and it would suck papers in, and one by one, it would make a copy of what was on the ditto. And this is it's a real pain because, first of all, you get blue ink all over it, your hands, and then you get it on your clothes, and you ruin your clothes. And then these dittos would last maybe for 1 year, and so next year you have to type the whole thing up again. So you can imagine how many hours teachers would take just to make dittos. It's unbelievable when I think about it now, because it's not like you do it once like we do today. It's like you have to do it each year, and then sometimes if you make a mistake, you'd have to go in and type it again. Sometimes when you put the ditto on this ditto machine, if it wasn't just right, it would get wrinkled and you'd ruin the ditto. You'd have to go type the whole thing up again. I'm telling you, it was just horrible, actually. Really was not a pleasant thing. So I call these the bad old days. And now it's much nicer because I call these the good new days because we use a copy machine. It's clean, it's fast, it's correctable. I mean, you know, the advantages just go on and on and on. And what's amazing to me is that, the take-home message here is that if you never lived before copy machines were invented, you have no idea what a miracle copy machines are. I mean, they really are a miracle. It's just night and day. Ask any teacher that's, my age or older on campus, ask them about dittos. See what they say. It wasn't pleasant. So if you think that the invention and wide distribution of copy machine technology is amazing, let's talk about an even more amazing system, your DNA. Just get some basic facts out. First of all, in the nucleus of every one of your cells are 23 pairs of chromosomes. And that means that because they're in pairs, you actually have 46 long chains of DNA in each cell. And that's except for your red blood cells, because your red blood cells don't have nuclei, but all other cells have that. In fact, if you actually do the math, it turns out that this will represent 6 billion base pairs in each cell, which is amazing, okay? So if you were to write all this out in a book using the type size of your AP Bio book, it would fill 900 books the size of your AP Bio book. That's how much information is there. It's a lot of information. And you can see there's a stack of maybe 20 AP Bio books over in the corner. So imagine 900 of those. And all that information is packed into the nucleus of one cell. It's remarkable. But wait, there's more. When each cell divides, it must copy all 6 billion base pairs. In other words, all 900 books of information. It must do that. And it's done in usually less than 2 hours with very few errors. In fact, the error rate is about 1 per billion base pairs. So this means that there are no more than 6 errors on average in 900 books. It's amazing. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to picture yourself at the fastest copy machine in the world trying to copy 900 books in less than 2 hours with less than 6 errors in the whole project. That's amazing. Just think about that. I just want you to get a visual on that. Well, how might you do this copying? Well, first of all, you're going to realize real fast that you can't do it with one copy machine and one person. So you're going to need to get a lot of copy machines, and you're going to need to get teams of copying, teams of people to work on this. And so each member of the team, to make it efficient, would have their own special role, kind of like a little assembly line. There might be a book picker-upper. There might be a page turner. There might be a copy cover opener and closer. Maybe you'd have a button pusher, and then a copy receiver. So all these people are important, right, to do the process. And what happens is the same process must occur in every cell. So you've got these specialized workers doing the part of the job, you know, to speed it up and make it more efficient. So that's what's going on with DNA. It's just like this. You've got lots of copiers. You've got a whole team of copiers, and they're working in multiple places at once to do this very quickly. Now, before we begin to talk about how it actually works, there's one rule that matters. And the one rule that matters is that DNA only copies in one direction. Can you all say that for me? DNA only copies in one direction. And what's that? What's the question that you're begging to know? Which direction? Which direction? And the answer is, new nucleotides are added to the 3' carbon of the sugar. So if you look at this picture to the right, look down here, you see a DNA nucleotide. Here's your ribose sugar. Here's your nitrogenous base. Here's your phosphate. Do you remember how we number the carbons? We number carbon 1 is the carbon attached to the nitrogenous base, carbon 2, carbon 3, carbon 4, and then there's carbon 5. So you always add to carbon 3. So we'd be if we were reproducing this DNA, we'd be adding down at the bottom here, because that's where the 3 carbon is, the 3' carbon. Up here, if we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the 5 carbon is up at the top, so we wouldn't be adding on that end. So there is a direction. This is always true, no exceptions, no kidding. Okay, let me introduce you to the team. We got a copy team here in every cell, and there's a whole bunch of enzymes, because look at ASE. When you see ASE, what do you think? When you see ASE, what do you think? Enzymes. So helicase is an enzyme, speeds up reactions. And its job is to unwind the DNA and separate it for copying at what's called the replication fork. So think about it. Helicase, you know, a helix. A helicase basically unwinds the helix. That's where it gets its name. Okay? Now, if you unwind the helix kind of wants to come back together. It's kind of sticky. It's like Velcro. It wants to come back together. It's those hydrogen bonds. So you need another member of the team called single-strand binding proteins. And what these guys do is they hold the 2 strands of DNA apart, because you need to hold them apart. Otherwise, they're going to want to come back together. Next enzyme is called primase. And the primase has kind of a weird job. And this is paradoxical to many biology students, because the primase actually starts copying using RNA nucleotides. So it actually makes a short little segment of RNA that's bound to the DNA. And we call this little segment a primer. And a lot of people just go, this is very strange, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Why would we begin the whole process? We're trying to duplicate DNA. Why would we start by a little section of RNA? It just seems kind of goofy. I've got my theory. I haven't read it anywhere, but I should go on Wikipedia or go on the internet after this lecture and see if this is speculation. I just, you know, it's kind of my idea. It's probably out there. Anybody know? Anybody have a guess as to why they think this might happen? Why would they start with RNA? Well, did I talk to you already this year about the the RNA world hypothesis. You guys remember that? I think I talked about it. No one knows. Okay. So the RNA world hypothesis is this. When nucleic acids were first developed in evolution, it's believed, the current theory is that RNA was the first nucleic acid. DNA was not. Do you remember that? Did I talk about that? Okay. And the reason why is because, for several reasons. First of all, RNA is much simpler than DNA. It's only single-stranded. And the other thing that's really amazing, and this is you're gonna find out more about this over the next several weeks, is that RNA does a lot more things than DNA does. DNA is kind of a dumb molecule. It doesn't do much. RNA does kind of like everything. I say it's like the Swiss Army knife of the cell. It does so many things. Like RNA can hold information. It can copy information. It can actually catalyze reactions. It can regulate what's going on in the cell. It does a ton of stuff. So we believe that RNA was the first nucleic acid. And if that's, and then, you know, DNA came along later. What we believe is that DNA sort of evolved later as a way to sort of protect the genetic information, because DNA is double-stranded. It's less likely to, you know, have mutations. In fact, the substitution of uracil for, in DNA it's thymine, but in RNA it's uracil. Turns out that the thymine is much more stable than the uracil, so it kind of is less likely to mutate or have problems. So we believe, you know, probably that the DNA is just evolved later as sort of a really safe place to leave the hereditary information, and that's all it does. It's kind of boring. It's kind of like a library. You know, a library is where there's information. Not much going on in a library, kind of boring place. You know, a lot of good information there. That's what DNA is like, where the RNA is running around doing all this crazy stuff. So RNA is kind of a way more interesting molecule, actually. So this may be why we have this sort of relic of evolution here. I don't know, but it's just my theory. Yeah. Yeah, there was, what happened, we're going to talk about that actually over the next couple weeks, so why don't you hold that question? Because in the late 50s and early 60s, they then had to sort of decode, like how does the DNA end up making proteins? You know, how does that all work? And that work was done later. Yeah. And I would say Crick was a part of that. Watson wasn't as involved. He was involved with it, but not, Crick was more involved. Okay, this next enzyme, polymerase. What is a polymer? What's a polymer? Scotty, what's a polymer? Good. A chain of, yeah, a whole bunch of monomers put together into a chain. Thank you, Scotty. Okay, a polymer. So what do you think DNA polymerase, what do you think it does? Just by looking at the word, not even looking at the definition. Yeah. Well, actually, that is a, because it's ACE, but an enzyme can either make things or break things. What do you think it's going to do here? What are we doing? We're actually making things. So it actually does the opposite. It actually adds nucleotides together and makes the, it's really the big, of all the molecules I'm going to tell you about on this slide, it's the most important one, because it's the one that adds the DNA nucleotides, beginning at the RNA primers, and really, it's the thing that replicates the DNA. The problem is, and you're going to see this in a minute, is that because the strands are anti-parallel, the DNA strands are anti-parallel, it can copy continuously on one strand, but it has to copy discontinuously on the other strand, and so you get these fragments. And the guy that discovered these fragments was Japanese, and he noticed, oh, they have to do it in these little sections, these little fragments. And he, you know, as any good scientist would, he named the fragments after himself. So he named them Okazaki fragments, because his last name was Okazaki. And there you go. You have to remove those primers because those primers are RNA. And so that's where DNA polymerase 2 comes in. It goes in and it basically removes the RNA primers and replaces it with DNA nucleotides. And then finally, you have to tie all those fragments together, and that's where the enzyme ligase comes in, because ligase basically ties all the individual fragments together once you're done. So that's the copy team. Let's see how they work. In the next slide, you'll see the cell cycle illustrated once again. And look up here, you guys. You'll see that the cell cycle, we've learned about mitosis, right? That's the part of the cell cycle we really know a lot about. But most of the cell cycle is interphase. And interphase is made of three parts, G1, S, and G2. And it's during the S phase that DNA replication occurs. So the lecture I'm giving you today is all about what occurs during this S phase. And so during the G1 phase, after mitosis is over, this is when the cell goes about its business, making proteins and so forth. And then during the S phase, that's when it doubles itself. So the doubling happens here. And so in G2, you've got twice as many chromosomes. But during this entire interphase, the one thing that's kind of interesting is you don't, if you were to look under a microscope, you wouldn't be able to see the DNA because it's not all compacted. It's all just sort of stretched out in the nucleus because you have to be able to get in there and make the messenger RNA, as we'll learn about next week. You don't get the crunching up of the chromosomes where you can really see them until the very end of G2, right before mitosis begins. So the classic picture that we see of a chromosome, what's really ironic is that only exists during mitosis and cytokinesis. During most of the cell cycle, the chromosomes don't look like that at all. They're all stretched out and you can't see them. So there you go. In the next slide, we're looking at DNA nucleotides. And this is just a review slide. You guys already know all this. But if you look at the nucleotide on the left, you'll see the sugar, which is either a ribosugar or a deoxyribosugar, depending on what you have at carbon 2, as you can see. The base will be coming off carbon 1, and there's all five bases. Remember, uracil is only found in RNA, and thymine is only found in DNA. And then you've got this phosphate group out here. It's a triphosphate. And so when you're making DNA, you have to use triphosphates because the phosphates provide the energy to cause the reaction to occur. And so on the next slide, you'll actually see adding nucleotide triphosphates here. You'll see the template strand in dark blue. You'll see the new strand in light blue. And you'll see at the bottom here, you'll see the ribosugar, and you see carbon 1, carbon 2, carbon 3. There's an OH coming off of carbon 3. That's where the new nucleotide triphosphate is going to come in. And what will happen is one phosphate will stay. It'll be the one that's in the backbone, but the other two will come off. And in the coming off, they give off energy that drives the process. And this next slide just wants to remind you that the strands run anti-parallel to one another, and it's illustrated very well in this slide because you can see the 3' end is at the bottom on the left, the 5' end is on the top on the left, and then you can see the other strand is flipped upside down with the 5' end going down and the 3' end going up. So you can see that they are indeed anti-parallel. Yeah. Oh, I mean, normally, this will be like millions and millions and millions. Yeah, yeah. Each chromosome is millions of these long. Yeah, amazing. Okay, in the next slide, you'll see the DNA replication. You can see the replication bubble there. I'm going to stop it. Okay, I'm stopping it. You can see that the replication, this is how replication occurs. You form a bubble, and it starts replicating both ways. And you can see in this illustration, the blue is the old strand and the green is the new strand. And so you get two new strands, two old strands. We'll turn it back on and let it continue. And it just keeps going until you finally get two daughter strands of DNA. That's basically a quick overview of what's going on. Now, let's take a little closer look. Here's your DNA. And you can actually see that there's multiple origins of replication. So I'm going to stop it again. And in reality, you got to do this quickly, right? You have 2 hours to copy, you know, 6 billion base pairs. So you've got to have multiple replication bubbles on all your chromosomes. So you got massive, crazy copying going on all at once. And then when the replication bubbles meet each other, it continues, and then the DNA fills in, and you end up with two daughter molecules. Okay, in the next slide, we're going to look at the synthesis of the leading strand. You see your replication, and in comes your helicase. Helicase unwinds, and then what happens is the helicase will form a replication. I'm stopping it now. You'll see a replication fork. The reason they call it the replication fork is it literally looks like a fork. And you can see some molecules coming in on top and below. What do you think those are going to be? Yeah. Right. And what are those called? Someone raise your hand. What do you think it's going to be called? Do you remember? You say that? Yeah, single-strand binding proteins. And so here they come, and they're going to hold the two apart, because otherwise they're going to come back together, right? Because they like the hydrogen bond together. Now the primase comes in and puts in some RNA. So I'm going to stop it really quickly. And you can see what we have here is we have just a short segment of RNA. It's called a primer. And it is RNA, and we've illustrated in a different color here. It's in red to illustrate that it's different than the DNA. And then the primer is oriented 5-3. What's going to come in now? DNA polymerase. And it's going to start adding DNA. So this is new DNA being added. And it's being added in the 5'-3' direction. And so there you go. Now, before we stop this, this is now called the leading strand. And I want to just illustrate this to you guys. The blue original is called the template. The leading strand is the strand that's going to continuously being produced. As the helicase unwinds, it's just going to keep going for the whole time. That's the leading strand. Sometimes it's called the 3' strand. Okay? Now, we go to the next slide. Now we're going to look at the lagging strand. The lagging strand is up on the top, and you can see that it has to be done in separate pieces, because it can only be added at the 3' end. So here's your primer. You're adding to the 3' end your new DNA, and you'll just keep doing that. But then now you're going to come over to the right of that, have a new primer, add some new DNA, because it can only add at the 3' end. So the 3' end is going to the left, not to the right. So that's where you get your Okazaki fragments coming in. And so as you can see now, we label them Okazaki fragments, and then those primers have to be removed, and they're replaced by DNA, and then the gaps are closed. And that's done by, here we go. We're going to have a detailed look at this. They're going to come in. The primase comes in, makes a primer of RNA. Now the DNA polymerase comes in, starts adding DNA, always adding to the 3' end. And then another primase is going to come in to the right, and it's going to form another primer, and then it's going to leave, and another DNA polymerase is going to come in, and it's going to start adding more DNA. And then once the DNA polymerase is added, what's going to happen to those two primers? They're going to be replaced with the DNA polymerase 2, and there you go. And after the DNA polymerase 2 adds DNA, then ligase comes in and ties it all together. And so that shows you the whole process. And that's called the lagging strand. The other one's called the leading strand. Okay, on the next slide, I show it in still frames over the next couple slides. I'm not going to go into this. You can just look at this on your at your leisure. And then I've got a beautiful summary slide here. This is from your book. And the summary slide shows everything going on kind of at once. And I want to note that the picture at the bottom looks upside down from the picture, the stuff I just showed you. But the reason why, look up in the upper right. You'll see that there's a replication bubble. We were looking at the right side of the replication bubble in our little animation, but this illustration is from the left side of the replication bubble. So if you look at this and think about it, you'll see why, oh yeah, this is what's going on. So it shouldn't be confusing. And then in the next slide, you see a movie of the whole process going on at once. You see the leading strand on the bottom. You see the lagging strand on top. You see the Okazaki fragments. You see the DNA polymerase 2 and the ligase coming in, and so on. So you can just keep watching that, and you know, should make sense to you. Are there any questions about that? Okay, if you want to see an accurate animation, what I've shown you is kind of diagrammatic representations. If you want to see an accurate animation of the whole process, go to the DNA Learning Center by clicking on the link, and you go to copying the code, then putting it together, and then replication, and you'll get to actually see what it looks like in real time. It's an amazing, amazing illustration. So that ends the lecture.